Today is November the 22nd, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and our website is pcradioshow.org. And my buddy, Joe King, is on the air with me.
Happy Thanksgiving, Hank.
Well, that's tomorrow, Joe, and I'm not ready for that turkey yet. But my appetite is up there. Hey, Joe, before we begin, I want to pick up from last week and the week before. We kept talking about Windows 10 upgrade, and just want to remind everyone that there is the free Windows 10 upgrade if you happen to have Windows 7, 8, or 8.1. But it ends December the 31st, and we told everyone how to do a workaround to make sure you get it even after the end of the year. Well, not get it after the end of the year, but it will still work after the end of the year if you can download the Windows 10 ISO file. And a question that some people started asking is, what do I do with the file? And let me just say that when you go to that website, when you download the ISO file, Microsoft. Now, by the way, you could download this from many other locations, but Microsoft is the only one we recommend you download from because it's pure, it's clean, and they tell you that if you download in a certain way, it will also download it to a flash drive, so you don't have to worry about, you know, burning it into a DVD or putting it onto a flash drive to run with it. So you should do that. But what an ISO drive is, or the ISO file...
ISO file and burn it into a DVD.
Nah, you know what? Why a DVD? Put it on a flash drive because it will last a lot longer and you're going to be using it in the future. And with a DVD, you get your potato chip fingerprints on it, and then you're going to say, where's my data, Joe?
So do you have to change anything in the system before you can boot up from a USB drive?
Well, if you do an upgrade, what you're doing is you're already booted up on your Windows 7, 8, or 8.1, and all you have to do is just run it from that drive. But if you want to do it as a fresh system, in other words, let's say you go through Windows 7 reinstall, you had to do a factory reset. A good example is we have to do a factory reset because let's say you got some ransomware to hit your system. What you do is you reinstall your original operating system, which is 7, 8, or 8.1, and then you could try to run with that ISO file, but if you can't run with it, you can boot it up. And to boot it up, you have to disable UEFI. UEFI is in the BIOS setup, which basically says it only looks for a legitimate Windows distribution to boot up, and you have to disable that to boot up off the flash drive.
Is that easy to do?
Yeah, it is easy. Of course, you know, the thing you accuse me of is I always say it's easy, and you say, yeah, for whom?
Well, no, it's always easy for anybody who knows how to do it. I don't know how to do it. What do I do?
Well, in your case, I hate to tell everyone, because I don't recommend what you do to everyone else, because what you do is you call me up, and I don't need the phone calls.
Oh, no, I'll give them your nighttime phone. That's not a problem.
No, Joe. No, what it is that, let me just repeat that again. If you were to key in a search on the following sentence, okay? Media, space, creation, space, Windows, space, 10, space, download.
Media, that's in a Google search box.
Yeah, and you'll find that Microsoft is not the first thing on that response or the query itself. It's a little further down. You want the Microsoft site, okay? And you download from the Microsoft site, and it will allow you, and it will match you up automatically, whether you need 32 bits or 64 bits, or it's home or premium or professional and so on. It'll give you the proper upgrade Windows 10. And you then have it, and you could burn it onto a DVD, or if you allow Microsoft to do it, they'll create this for you automatically on a USB flash drive.
You know, Hank, this is not just for folks who are right now upgrading or want to upgrade in December or January. Everybody should have this as a backup, because sometimes what I used to call the hidden partition is not as full and as thorough as we thought it was, and they might have to do a restore from this this new system that you're just giving them.
Well, what it is that, let's say back in the summer of 2015, you bought a new machine, and that's about, you know, a little bit more than 2 years ago, and it came with Windows 7. And because Windows 10 was released in November of 2015, and you said, gee, I wish to get Windows 10, and you got a free upgrade to Windows 10. After you've gotten the free upgrade to Windows 10, you were running with it, and somehow the system degraded because of some malware or whatever it may be, and you need to reinstall the operating system. Well, if you don't have Windows 10 to reinstall with, what you normally would do is you just do a factory reset, brings you back to Windows 7, and that's how I conclude that Microsoft would, you know, if you download that Windows 10 ISO file, you have that Windows 10 to reinstall with. If you don't have it, then, you know, what they're going to do is they're going to pull it. They're not going to make that available after December 31st.
Ah, that's so nice of them.
Well, I'm going to remind everyone of this between now and the end of the year, and if anyone really has difficulty understanding it or they want a little more clarity because I'm looking at it from a technical point of view, send me an email message to hank@pcradioshow.org. And that's important, okay, because I want everyone to get this right. Joe, the other thing I want to do is I want to do a follow-up on last week. There might have been some confusion because you said something a little different than what I said. It may be a pronunciation. What I said was that I was talking about mouse trails, and what happens is that when you uninstall a program, most of these uninstallers do not give you a clean uninstall. What happens is that they leave artifacts, or it's called, the technical term is leftover artifacts, but the glib term that, you know, a lot of techie use is mouse trails.
Well, they also use another four-letter word, which I'm going to say, but it's mouse followed by something.
Well, the funny part was I did a Google search on the on two words, mouse trails. I cannot find the fact that they're leftover artifacts. You know that? I was surprised by that. And they kept coming up with Microsoft mouse and a trailing tail on it. And I say, no, that's not it. What we mean by what happens is that, now, Joe, I know that you're going to talk about it, you know, maybe next week or you'll talk about it. When you uninstall a program, you think that the whole thing is completely uninstalled. Not true at all. Most of these uninstallers, they leave things behind so that they can, when you reinstall, the operating parameters are still there. Most people don't realize that when we use the term operating parameters, it means like, okay, you know, how do you want the screen set up, or how do you want the the password and so on. That's called operating parameters. Microsoft, in their infinite wisdom, don't use that term. The term they use is registry. Registry is operating parameters, and some of the operating parameters are left there, and unless you are very careful, I don't recommend that, you know, unless you know what you're doing, you know, I don't recommend the average person to do it. And what some of these applications do is, okay, you don't like my program, I let you uninstall it, but I leave mouse trails in the registry area. And sometimes you get these pop-up messages, say, wait a minute, I uninstalled it. How come I'm still getting a message from this company saying, and you have a hard time doing a deep uninstall on it. The program I use is called IOBIT. And you had mistakenly used the term IOBite. It's IOBIT.
Yes, it is IOBIT. I apologize for it was not just mispronunciation. It was really a cognitive error. I was thinking that it was IOBite. It's not. It's IOBIT.
Yeah. And the program is called IOBIT, IOBIT, Uninstaller 7, and it's free. And it works very well. And I'll tell you how well it works, okay, is that we were talking about it the other day, Joe, where remember in the early days of the Norton antivirus program, if you didn't want it, you want to uninstall it. And boy, they make you go through hoops and saying, are you sure you want to uninstall it? Yes, I want to uninstall it. And you can't uninstall it. And then they give you instructions on how to manually do it. And you say, wait a minute, why do you do that? Well, they did it purposely, all right? So, and then now we have browsers where people are throwing up plugins. You know what I mean by plugins, right, Joe? You know, okay, you know, these optional to do things that's added to the browser itself. Well, they're hidden in many cases. And when you uninstall a browser, guess what? Those plugins are still there. And sometimes those plugins are very malicious. They affect other programs, too.
And sometimes the plugins will stay and they look for the original thing that they were a plugin for and not find it. I had that actually happen today. It was looking for a part of the program that I had just erased. And I went back into it, and I could not figure it out. I took a hint that Hank gave me. I reinstalled the program and then used something like IOBit uninstall it to take it out, and it was clean. Incidentally, I do want to say, Hank, that a lot of people know IOBit for its anti-malware programs. You have to, in this case, look for IOBit uninstaller, not
uninstaller,
malware.
Right. Now, there's a companion program that I also use that I mentioned last week, and some people say, can you spend a little more time talking about it? It's called Advanced System Care Free. It's from IOBit Uninstaller. Advanced with a D in it, ADVANCED, System Care as one word, free. And this does a very nice cleanup. It cleans up extraneous files. In other words, it's sort of like a combo C cleaner and using a registry cleaner all at one time. I use it and it cleans it up. To give you an idea, I wound up using this program along with the uninstaller because last year I bought a Black Friday special, and it had 32 gigabyte of storage on it, which is not much. And by the time the Windows 10 was fully initialized, I had something like 10 gigs available, which is okay. I can use that. But when you start getting all these patches and updates from Windows and you start installing one or two programs, all of a sudden I was down to, I got less than 1 gig left. Then I realized why, because the virtual memory uses that area. So I had to clean up a lot of the stuff. And this is a very effective program, Advanced System Care, and it's free. And
it's now up to version 11, and while it's at the IOBit site, it was made by IOBit. It does not have the name IOBit in the heading.
Yes, I know that. Oh, Joe, you know, one of the things, before we cover another topic that's very important, I just want to say that this is a time when we were talking about it, that when you download a program, try to say save and not run. In other words, some of them, like I know when I'm running with Windows 10 with the Google engine on it, the Google would say, do you want to save it or run it? I want to save it. I don't want to run it. And the reason why is that when I save it, then I can look at the name. I'll name the site, okay? You know, one of the things that we used to do quite frequently was, we would give various sites and stores and so on and products thumbs up or thumbs down. CNET, C-N-E-T. It's a credible company, but the problem is that anytime you download anything from CNET, and the other name they use is download.com, is that you download their download manager. You know, it's sort of like an extra step. And when you download their download manager, hey, Joe, what do you think happens?
Well, it does download. It does manage your download, but it also gives you some freeware or beggarware
that you don't want, and it changes the search engine, too, on you.
I noticed that very often it changes the default search engine, sometimes to something well worthwhile, but sometimes to something really nasty.
Yeah, so what you should do is just say, I just want to save it, and then you can look at what you really want to install and forget about the rest of the stuff, all right? So that's what you should do. Hey, Joe, there's one thing that came up in the past week that's very important, and that's Google. What happened was their cloud service was down, but it wasn't really down. It was Google Docs that was down. Joe, you had some strong comments on that.
I do indeed. I give you a hypothetical case. You're in a law firm. You're preparing a brief that you've got to go to court this afternoon with this new brief, this new appeal for something. and you open up your computer and you pull down the brief that you typed last night at home, and the reason it was on Google Docs is because you did type it at home, and guess what's not there? Google Docs. It's not there. It's gone. Where is Google Docs? My friend, you have just become one of the many, many, many people who have discovered why using the cloud, anything in the cloud, for something that is crucial is really a big mistake. I would not keep my books in the cloud, my pictures in the cloud, anything that I might need to reference for an important situation. If I use the cloud, I have to have a backup on an external drive at my office. Otherwise, I would never use the cloud. Hank, do you disagree with me?
Oh, I agree with you completely. And what I also tell people is that Google, and they do it in an honest way, okay? Google tried to be very efficient and fast on your search. And so what they do is they do an advanced look ahead. And in order to do that, the more they know about you, the faster they can do a look ahead. In other words, if you, like I know when I key in the word weather, W-E-A-T-H-E-R, well, they know who I am. They know where the IP address is from before. They've already identified that IP address, where the location is. And before I can even type in the zip code, it's up there already. Now, that you would say, that's good. But you know what the negative part is? In being able to be efficient, they've collected an awful lot of personal information about me.
Yes, they are. Hank, while you were talking, just for the heck of it, I went to that IOBIT site looking for that new thing you mentioned that does not have the IOBIT name in it. And sure enough, it was there called Advanced System Care 11 Free. Mm-hmm. Click here for a free download. What would you think would happen next?
Well, I would do a save on the download, and if it looks like a download manager, I would look elsewhere.
Didn't give me a chance to do a save, so I'll do it now in front of you.
No. Joe, let me just say that if you were to ask me what are credible sites to download from, okay?
Wait, let me just finish, Hank. What I always tell people is download from the developer if possible.
Right.
So I went to the developer, and I clicked download. And do you know what the next screen I had was?
Something else.
Download.cnet.com.
Right. And the reason why is it's a little guy that cannot afford the website for downloading. So he goes to CNET, and CNET says, oh, we'd be happy to do it for you. And, of course, there's always a gotcha on that.
Well, the gotcha here is unless you're extremely careful, you're not going to get the free download. You're going to get the 25% discount on the pro version. I still don't see exactly where the free download is. I'm going to try scrolling down the page. Okay. Incidentally, CNET is now owned by CBS. And what can I tell you? CNET was not this bad in the old days.
Oh, listen, come on. We could always ask Charlie Rose to give us the URL, right? No comment. Forget it. Forget I said it. Okay.
Hank, don't get me started. You know, I can go on for at least 3 days without taking a deep breath.
Oh, hey, tomorrow, are you going to visit your relatives for Thanksgiving?
The only relative I'm going to be visiting is my wife.
Oh, listen, you know, this is the time of the year where we get together and, we really, you know, we should spend quality time with friends and family and not be all caught up with all our electronic gadgetry, you know that?
Well, it depends. If our family is interested in electronic gadgetry, it gives them a chance to ask for advice or for tech tips. Hank, you're very good on one-sentence tech tips.
Well, maybe I'll do that in the future, and I'll run off a whole bunch of them like Henny Youngman. No, I have two granddaughters coming in from California to visit me, and I'm going to tell them, put those tablets away. You talk to Grandpa. You're not going to talk to Grandpa by texting, okay? Hey,
well,
Joe.
I don't really know how old those kids are today, but I remember when they were 3 or 4 or 5 years old, and they would come in from California to visit with Grandpa. And you know what Grandpa did? He took all of his computers and locked them up in the closet and had 2 or 3 computers he bought just for them so that they could play with them and foul them up and it wouldn't matter.
Let's get to the next subject. we have prepared the following feature segments of interest. I will be doing a first look review of Firefox version 57.0, the newly released browser, and I am, well, guess what? We'll get to it, but I am impressed by it. This will be followed by Alfred Poor's segment on wearable and health technology, in which he covers brain scans can identify adolescents with suicidal thoughts, the first pill with a sensor approved by the FDA, and finally, a flexible battery helps light up a smart dental brace. And I will be covering from the workbench, Black Friday, there are notebooks, and how do they differ? And Marty Winston will take up the home automation with his Thanksgiving thoughts. First look. A new version of Firefox from Mozilla. It is Firefox Quantum Browser version 57.0. It was released November the 14th, just last week. It delivers faster performance and lower RAM usage. It runs on Windows, Mac OS, Linux, Android, and iOS. There's a portable version of Firefox for Windows. The only difference between Firefox and Firefox Portable is the platform itself. The portable version of Firefox runs without making any changes to the computer's hard disk or solid state drive. I've been using it and it works very well. Mozilla hopes to recapture their former market share that was just under 30% a few years ago. All versions of Firefox currently installed is only 9.1% of the market share. Firefox claims to use 30% less RAM than Chrome and runs much faster than Chrome. Firefox was built on a completely overhauled core engine with brand new technology. Firefox Quantum is reported over twice as fast as Firefox, with a brand new technology with a beautiful, and I really do mean beautiful, new UI look. The first thing you notice is speed. The second thing you notice is that this new interface called Photon is fast and smooth. The designers created a system which they call Pocket Integration. This includes Pocket recommendations alongside your most visited pages. Google is their new default search provider in the United States and Canada. With more than 60 search providers pre-installed across more than 90 languages, Firefox now has more choice search providers than any other browsers. Firefox takes better advantage of hardware with multiple cores that are optimized for low power consumption. With Firefox, the tab you're on gets prioritized over all others, making better use of your valuable system resources. Firefox is now a multi-process browser. Firefox used to run everything in a single process, in other words, single-threaded, everything in a linear fashion, which meant a slow web page could slow down your entire browser interface. And if a web page crashed the browser, everything would go down instead of just a single tab. With Firefox 54, Firefox used two processes, one for the user interface and one for the web pages. Firefox Quantum, which is 57, uses even more. Firefox Quantum doesn't just open new process for each tab. Instead, Firefox uses a maximum of four processes for web page content by default. Even better, you, the user, can configure the number of processes that Firefox uses if you want more or less on your PC. You don't want the multi-process browser? That's easy. Just set the content process limit to one and it will behave just like the last version of Firefox. And with traditional Firefox extensions, well, this has changed. With all these changes, Firefox had to make a break from the past. Traditional Firefox extensions are no longer supported. Instead, Firefox now supports web extensions, which are more limited in what they can do and similar to Google Chrome and Microsoft Edge extensions. Firefox has supported both traditional extensions and web extensions for quite some time. Some of the extensions you use may already be web extensions that will continue to function normally. However, some extensions will be left behind because of this switch. If you rely on extensions that haven't updated yet, you can switch to Firefox ESR, which stands for Extended Support Releases, to keep you running on an older version of Firefox. After June the 26th of 2018, you'll have to upgrade to a newer version of Firefox, and ESR will no longer be supported as a legacy feature. With this new Firefox, I've been using it. It's smooth, and I really like the handling of it. I especially like the portable version.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Did you ever wish that you could look inside somebody's head and see what they were thinking? That is a problem that takes on special meaning when you're the parent of an adolescent and you're worried about their mental health, especially when you're concerned about them possibly being suicidal or having thoughts about injuring themselves. Well, there's maybe help in sort of an unexpected way. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon had done some interesting research using brain scan imaging. They used an artificial intelligence machine learning system to look at the different brain images that they got for a collection of adolescent patients. And they discovered the system was able to identify which of those patients matched up with either suicidal thinking or thoughts of injuring themselves. And in fact, the study found that the machine learning system was accurate 91% of the time. Even more than that, they were able to identify which of those patients had actually attempted suicide with a 94% accuracy. So this is pretty remarkable stuff. It means that by just matching the patterns and the differences between the brain scans of these adolescent patients, they should be able to predict whether or not that child is at risk for suicide or self-injury. So this is really quite a remarkable use of artificial intelligence and digital health technology. Chances are very good that you're like me and you have to take one or more maintenance medications every day. One of the things my wife frequently asks me is, did you remember to take your pills today? In fact, it costs the U.S. billions of dollars every year simply because patients don't take their medication the way they're supposed to. So this week, a very important milestone occurred. The FDA has approved the first pill that includes a sensor that can then be used to determine whether or not the pill has been taken. The patient actually wears a small adhesive patch on their stomach, and as the pill passes by, the sensor in the pill registers on the controller, and a record is made that that pill was taken. This first approval by the FDA is for tagging the pills of a medication called Abilify. It's used to treat schizophrenia, manic episodes of bipolar disorder, and also is in some cases for depression in adults. Because of the nature of the conditions that it treats, it's very important that the patients stay on their medication and that there be a way to monitor whether or not they're actually taking their pills. So this sensor on a pill is going to make it possible for physicians and caregivers to make sure that the patient takes the pills as they're supposed to throughout the day, and hopefully will improve the outcomes, make treatment more effective, and will save money overall. Well, there may be some people whose smile lights up the room, but now I want to talk about a device that actually lights up your smile. Now, that sounds strange, but what this is there's a new development. It's actually only in the prototype stage now, but what it is a new smart dental brace. The idea here is that near-infrared radiation, infrared light, can actually speed the healing process and make a dental brace more effective. Now, what happens is you need to get power to the lights in the braces, but regular batteries don't work well. They tend to be inflexible and large and not necessarily in a format that's helpful. Well, a bunch of researchers at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, also known as KAUST, it's a research university in Saudi Arabia, they've come up with a flexible battery that can be incorporated right into the dental braces and thus provide power for the LEDs. Furthermore, the device is programmable, and so the individual LEDs can be controlled for each individual tooth. So you can control the brightness and control the effect of the light therapy for each individual tooth as needed. The batteries are non-toxic, they don't leak, and you can easily pop out the braces to plug them in to recharge them. This is kind of an exciting use for a flexible battery, kind of unusual, but it could also help make these dental braces more effective and require less time to accomplish the same goals as a straight mechanical one. As I mentioned, still in the prototype stage, but the inventors hope that they can take this into clinical trials soon and get it on its way to becoming a commercial reality. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. There are notebooks and there are notebooks, ranging in price from under $200 into the thousands. They differ in speed, connectivity, memory, and storage capacity, and screen options. Before you jump at the purchase of a Black Friday special, here are some tips before you make that commitment. If at all possible, you should have at minimum a cursory window shop look of the unit itself for touch, fit, and finish of the product, or a similarly built product from the same manufacturer. There are differences also in platform design with the clam shape, the 2-in-1 convertible, and the notebook with a detachable keyboard. Try to identify the manufacturer model and do the research online for specifications. On low-end units, the memory is soldered onto the motherboard, which means you cannot upgrade the memory. On low-end units, the eMMC storage, otherwise known as the embedded media card, for storage is not replaceable. As the operating system increases in size by updates and patches, the amount of usable storage of the computing system severely restricts what applications can be used unless you make external storage capacity available. Many of the low-end notebooks use older generations of CPU, as many manufacturers clear the inventory of hardware in that fashion. The introduction of a new model low-end cost notebook does not mean it is installed with the latest CPU architecture. With Intel, as they introduce a new CPU generation, there are generally four types of upgrades. One is the increase in circuitry density. There is the lowering of voltage requirements, which of course results in longer battery life. And there's optimization in instruction execution. These three are hardware factors that contribute to the overall performance of the CPU. The implementation mix of these features results in a total of 6 separate processor Intel brands. There is the Celeron and Pentiums, which are both budget brand names, and the processors in both lines tend to be differentiated by clock speed. They're all dual-core CPUs with no turbo boost, no hyper-threading, and just 3 megabytes of cache. The Core i3, where they start using the i, these CPUs are still dual-core, meaning 2 cores, but they add hyper-threading to it, which represents 2 logical processor cores to the operating system for every 1 physical core. The Core i5, these are all quads, that means 4 core CPUs without hyper-threading, and they probably represent the best balance of price and performance for high-end users. They also use Intel's Turbo Boost feature, which lets the CPU run at higher clock speeds when there's enough thermal headroom or when fewer cores are being actively used. The Core i7, these are the best described as Core i5 chips with hyper-threading, higher clock speeds, and 8 megabytes of cache. Otherwise, they're the same as the i5. As with the Core i3 CPUs, hyper-threading definitely does help performance in heavily threaded programs, but jumping from a Pentium or Core i3 to a Core i5 will get you a much larger performance bump as you're going from one core to the other. The Core i9 is the very latest from Intel. The Core i9 is consisted of 2 different models. There's the 18-core i9-7980X and the 16-core i9-7960X. The fourth factor, which I talked about as being upgrades, impacts directly on the operating system itself. Intel has been adding customized computing instructions to increase the efficiency of Windows. Microsoft has already announced that future Windows 10 upgrades will not run on older processors. We are currently in the 8th generation of the Intel Core architecture. Well, how do you know what architecture it might be that you're buying or that you currently have? The clue to their age is in the CPU model number. I'll give you an example of that. The Core i3-7100U, the 7, meaning the first number in the chip itself, represents the 7th generation chip, whereas the iCore 5-8250U is an 8th generation chip. Right now, we're up to the 8th generation, which was newly announced, and the performance difference there is not in speed, but in lower voltage capability, giving longer battery life. Check what connectivity is built into that laptop that you might be interested in. Another thing you should check into is the Bluetooth standard now is 5.0, but many units may still only have 4.1. It's not that big a difference, but over the longer term, you really would like to have Bluetooth 5.0. USB 3.0 is fast becoming the de facto standard. However, some notebooks offer both standards of 3.0 and 2.0 in the notebook, while other notebooks have only USB 2.0 connectivity. Check which one you want, and if you really need both, make sure it's there. If you only need one of two, make sure that the unit that you want is either 3.0 or 2.0. HDMI for video output should be a basic requirement. Unfortunately, many low-end units do not have an Ethernet port for hardwire online connection. This provides for greater security over wireless, and if you have any needs for financial transactions, such as buying from Amazon or buying from anyone else, you really want that purchase to be online, secure, and a hardwire would do that. Modern notebook units today include an SD or micro SD card reader. Find out which SD standard is built into the notebook. You have the SD 2.0 or SDHC standard that can only address 32 gigabytes of storage, whereas if it's SD 3.0 or the SXHC, which can address up to 2 terabytes of storage, obviously you want the one that is SXHC. Finally, on low-cost notebooks, there is Windows Notebooks and there are Chromebooks. The advantage of the Chromebook is the ability to efficiently do a factory reset of the operating system. And it's quick and easy, and when you do a reset on it, everything is updated properly. With Windows 10, factory reset of Windows 10 is not for the faint of heart. However, the advantages of a Windows Notebook is that you don't have to worry about printing. Printing is pretty direct as soon as you install a printer. And there is access to all the mainstream applications, which includes one that the Chromebook does not have, which is text preparation. If you're using a Chromebook just to go on the internet, check your email, and browse the internet, and that's all you do, that's fine. There are laptops, and there are laptops, and for Black Friday, caveat emptor.
Okay, so by now, most of you know that I'm designing and will build a 40-year maintenance-free, energy-miserly, cybernetic house. There's some info about it at 40yearhouse.com, but Hank asked me to talk about what happens to the occupants over 40 years. Well, guaranteed they won't get any younger, and with aging comes other changes in hearing, in vision, in body strength, and so on. So Hank asked if I knew of a lightweight chainsaw, for example. I'm not falling for that one. It gets pretty dangerous, even for octogenarians who can lift chainsaws, as soon as there's any doubt about how well they can see what it's doing or how well they can control it. I won't get into discussions about whether this should be an aging-in-place house or a multiple-generation house. It's a house. It's designed to monitor and adjust itself. It's designed to long delay any need for any major maintenance, but there's still housekeeping to do and minor maintenance like changing filters. For that matter, Hank has another misconception about the house. He asked me, as electronics get smaller and faster and standards for things like cabling change, how will I future-proof the house to always be state-of-the-art? It's not intended to be. I can't go 40 years into the future and bring back what the state of the art will be like then and hope it will all be backwards compatible. I have to go another way. The house is intended to keep working that long, with some reasonable, occasional, and relatively minor replacements needed. The UPS batteries, for example, will need changing 5 to 8 times between now and then. And at some point, maybe the UPSs themselves, small stuff. The cybernetic control systems have nodes dedicated to monitoring the health of other nodes, in some cases triggering cold spares into taking over the roles of failed nodes, and in every case notifying the occupant with a detailed email message. The power has 3 backups. The data has 3 backups. And the system has a good many as well. I might add that most of the time, there's more than one sensor in more than one technology monitoring key areas. And when those readings aren't in harmony, again, the system can send a message to the occupant with a recipe or a prescription for fixing it, or hiring somebody to fix it, or asking a friend or neighbor to fix it. Why so many sensors? Because it helps reduce false alarms and can help add qualification attributes to the readings. Take the apron of the driveway, for example. There's a buried double coil that knows when a big metal thing crosses over it and in which direction. There's a pair of infrared beams that break when something crosses their path. And because we do it twice, that also gives us direction. There are surveillance cameras that detect motion. There's a Bluetooth beacon reader that tells us if the car is one we know, and we'll be adding both license plate and logo recognition for identifying frequent visitors. If all of that seems too redundant, consider how the various readings prevent thinking a car is driving up when it's a pedestrian, or a cyclist, or a deer. In the garage, we're hacking the openers to do something that's nominally illegal, letting automation open them. That's a no-no, because the inrush of air can mean spontaneous combustion for gasoline, kerosene, methane, or propane fumes, for example. We're adding 2 elements to the garage for safety's sake. One is combustible gas sensor monitoring. The other is an industrial-class brushless exhaust fan. We can use existing lighting to alert an incoming driver that there will be a delay before the garage door opens without creating arcs or sparks in the garage. The combustible gas sensor monitoring tells us when to turn on that exhaust fan, and the exhaust fan clears the fumes before a human enters. So it isn't so much, as Hank wanted, it isn't so much about finding tools that elders can heft. It's more about designing the house to integrate tools that let new occupants comfortably and safely age into becoming elders. Our 40-year house isn't built yet, so we're not spending this Thanksgiving there, but Thanksgiving is a time for giving thanks. And I'd like to offer mine. First, my thanks to the men and women of the Cyber Command. That's an Army-led joint service base, NSA is there too, that identifies and finds ways to counter cyber attacks. They're our strongest and probably most secretive defense. They know what's coming in, they learn how to block it, they learn how to work against it, they learn how to thwart it. Similarly, on the civilian side, I also want to thank all of the U.S. and worldwide volunteer hackers, the good guys, who are pursuing the same goal. We're being attacked, there's no denying it, and it's nice to see these guys trying to deny them any benefit from their evilly intended efforts. I want to give thanks for the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B. It's an extraordinary little thing, a deliberately inexpensive, deliberately powerful little computer. But it's one that makes more computers available to more people than anything ever before, and especially to the experimenter community that grew up around the Raspberry Pi and keeps exploring new and potentially big ideas for these little computers. I want to give thanks for the radio computer shows that continue to air, this one and others, even though most of them are, to be candid, volunteer efforts. That's a lot of dedication from a lot of people to help as many people as care to turn on the radio. I want to give thanks for the neighborhood geeks, and every neighborhood has one. You know, these are the people who allow themselves to be recruited when some problem arises that they can help get solved with less frustration, less stress for people around them. Some of them work for a six-pack, a plate of cookies, or just a thank you. I want to give thanks for search engines and wikis. Now, we remember the days when it took so much longer to locate much less information, much less current information. And since, you know, my life, I live by a mantra that says, never stop learning. Well, these learning enablers are of tremendous value, and I am thankful that I'm in a time when they're available to me. I also want to give thanks for smartphones, not so much because they're phones, which is cool enough, but because they're such Swiss Army knives of things that it's fun to have on hand, it's useful to have on hand, but that you really would hate to have to carry. You know, it's not just a phone, it's a camera, it's a calculator, it's a map, it's a weather station, it's a handheld game. For all the things that are in them, I am really thankful that just carrying that phone gives me all of that utility. I want to give some thanks for MEMS. That's something you may or may not know. It's MEMS stands for Micro Electromechanical Systems. It's a way of building really smart things, teeny tiny things on a chip. Because MEMS devices, MEMS construction makes it possible to make sensors, for example, with otherwise unapproachable accomplishments available, and they're nearly as small as the seeds in a rye bread. And also, because the almost unimaginable advancements that these centers can enable, even in the hands of individuals, can make for positive changes in the safety and convenience of all of our lives. I want to give thanks for Amazon, because at the end of the day, they're doing things that make shopping better for you and me and the people who do the shopping. It's still several miles short of perfect, but among all of the options out there, Amazon seems to most respect that my time isn't worthless. They make my time shopping as convenient as they can, help me find stuff, help me compare stuff, make it easy to get my hands on it, and I don't have to leave home. For my leisure time, I'd like to give thanks for Rocky Patel's cigars and for the Macallan single malt scotch, my favorites. But at the same time, I'd also like to give thanks for Weller soldering gear, for all the great tools from Ryobi and Klein and Dremel, for the neat equipment from Triplett and Keysight and CyberPower and Supermicro and Audio-Technica. The technology that makes us more productive these days wasn't always here. So it's worth a little nod of the head to say, hey, guys, thanks for making that part of life a little better. I certainly want to give thanks for my wife and kids, whose love I never take for granted, but who always grant it. I want to give thanks for Ohm and Watt and Planck and Henry and Faraday, and even for Murphy, whose laws teach that there may be order buried in this chaos. I certainly want to give thanks to the late Dr. Jerry Purnell, who showed us all that when you talk about tech the same way you'd tell a fishing story, it's much more engaging and a lot easier to understand. Jerry has done so much to help generations feel comfortable with things that were otherwise really complicated. I want to give thanks for Hank and Joe making room for me on their show. I want to give thanks to the 21 Club, where I got to taste the best profiterole ever. I do want to give thanks to Diana Krall and Stacy Kent for voices that make every adult male fall a little bit in love when they sing. Certainly, I would like to acknowledge and give thanks for LeBron James, not so much for his basketball maneuvers, which are legendary, but for showing so many people through his off-court activities the true meanings of class and grace. And, of course, I want to give thanks especially for the active duty military men and women and the first responders who commit their skills and their lives to our safety. I thank you. And to those of you who are listening, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements for Computer Club meetings in the Northeast Tri-State area. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, November the 28th, 7 p.m. at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on augmented reality with Microsoft HoloLens. Meeting is on Thursday, November the 30th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on web browser shootouts Friday, December the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a presentation on Minecraft, Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys just in time for Christmas, Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m. Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, December the 7th, 7 p.m. Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. Long Island Mac Users Group will be meeting Friday, December the 8th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Toolkit of Tips and Tricks, Thursday, December the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. All these meetings are open to the public, and you're all welcome to attend, and we hope to see you there. A Thanksgiving message. For some, Thanksgiving Day is when major rivalries are playing football or the start of Black Friday shopping. However, for many families and friends, it is the time of the year to gather together to thank the Lord for the many blessings we have received. The true tradition of Thanksgiving Day is when we set aside time to give thanks and to be in the company of family and friends. Let's go back on this day to communicate the old-fashioned way. Put away the smartphone, the tablet, and the computer and go back to the old-fashioned practice of face-to-face communications with each other. For this Thanksgiving Day, enjoy the holiday. Turn off the electronics. Instead of logging on, we should engage in exercise and real meaningful conversation with each other. Besides, it's hard to eat turkey with one hand and text with the other. We don't know what tomorrow may bring, but we thank all the listeners who have supported us this past year. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Let's not forget, we thank all members of the military, past and present, for their service. The website of the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, very important to back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening and stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.